From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the great soul and country singing of Ted Hawkins. He's made several acclaimed recordings, but instead of leading to a career in clubs and coffee houses, he always winds up back performing on the streets. This may change with Ted Hawkins' new major label release. His voice is often compared to Sam Cooke and Otis Redding. Also today, a talk about feminism, advertising, and turning 60 with Gloria Steinem. And we remember John Preston, who died last week of AIDS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. A Detroit jury has found Dr. Jack Kevorkian not guilty of violating Michigan's assisted suicide law. The jurors acquitted Kevorkian in the suicide of Thomas Hyde, who died from inhaling carbon monoxide, which Kevorkian admitted providing. Juror Nurse Gail Donaldson says she voted to acquit Kevorkian because his intention was to end Hyde's suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease. Another juror said she believed the intent was not to kill Hyde, but to relieve his pain. After the verdict, Kevorkian talked with reporters about his motives for fighting the Michigan law.
This wasn't really entirely selfless on my part. It's selfish partly. I want that option as I get older. And I want it unencumbered, unintimidated, free with my medical colleagues. So I did it for myself, too, just as every competent adult would want to do.
Wayne County Assistant Prosecutor Timothy Kenny says the emotion of the case made it hard for the jury to be objective about the law. Nelson Mandela claimed victory today for the African National Congress in South Africa's historic all-race elections. The vote count is continuing, but the ANC has a commanding lead over President F.W. de Klerk's National Party. Mandela says the ANC is delighted by the overwhelming support they've received. He says other leaders, including de Klerk, have called him to offer cooperation and congratulations. Mandela said he congratulates de Klerk for the 4 years in which, as Mandela puts it, they worked together, quarreled, addressed sensitive problems, and at the end could shake hands and drink coffee. The UN official in charge of peacekeeping operations says the U.S. may be the only country capable of organizing an international response to the bloodshed in Rwanda. NPR's Caroline Clark Kelly reports.
Kofi Annan, the Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, briefed members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on Rwanda, saying the UN is confronted with a staggering level of violence and suffering there. He believes that African countries in the region can't respond quickly enough on their own to make a difference. He says an international effort is needed, and the U.S. is in the best position to coordinate it.
Even if for reasons that perhaps we all know, the U.S. is not ready to get involved directly, with troops on the ground, perhaps it can help the international community mobilize resources to help bring about law and order.
The Clinton administration is said to be considering the option of organizing and helping to pay for a peacekeeping force made up of troops from nearby African nations. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 20 points in heavy trading. In over-the-counter trading, the NASDAQ is up more than 6 points. This is NPR News. Health officials worried about reports that deadly skin cancers are increasing are urging people to respect the power of the sun. At a news conference today, Dr. Howard Koh of the Boston University School of Medicine called skin cancer an enormous public health epidemic. Dr. Peyton Weary of the American Academy of Dermatology repeated the warning against tanning parlors, saying there's no such thing as safe ultraviolet radiation. The doctors also advise people to stay out of the sun during the peak hours of the day and to use hats and sunblock lotions. A cyclone is battering large parts of southeastern Bangladesh, an area devastated by a similar storm 3 years ago. Islands off the coast are being swept by heavy rains and high winds. Mark Tully reports from the capital, Dhaka.
Winds of more than 220 kilometers per hour are now battering the southeast Bangladeshi town of Teknaf. Early reports speak of trees being uprooted and roofs being blown off houses. There's no information yet about the tidal wave, which it's expected will cause the worst devastation. The Meteorological Office fears the tides could be 18 feet above their normal level. The cyclone is expected to hit Bangladesh's largest port, Chittagong, shortly. But the Meteorological Office now says it doesn't think the western coast will be affected. Throughout the day, the government, the Red Crescent Society, and non-governmental relief organizations have been using all the communications media at their disposal to persuade people to leave low-lying areas and move to cyclone shelters or higher ground.
Mark Tully for the BBC. Secretary of State Christopher says he's happy so far with the results of the shuttle diplomacy he's been conducting between Israel and Syria. In Israel today, Christopher said the two sides are discussing a broad range of issues, and he says that's significant. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ted Hawkins, is a great singer with a voice reminiscent of Sam Cooke and Otis Redding, and a style that's a unique blend of soul, country, and folk. He's been discovered and rediscovered, but keeps ending up on the boardwalk in Venice, California, where he sung on and off for over 20 years. He's hoping that now at the age of 57, his new major label recording will change things for good. In the 1980s, he had two recordings on Rounder that didn't sell much here, although one of them became a hit in England. In fact, Hawkins moved there in the late 80s, but as a result of visa problems in 1990, he returned to the States and to being a street musician. A lot of his music will be in circulation now. Rounder is reissuing their two records on CD, and Geffen has just brought out the new album, The Next 100 Years. From it, this is the Webb Pierce song, There Stands the Glass.
The glass that will ease all my pain, that will settle my brain, is my first one today. There stands the glass that will drown all my fears, that will hide all my tears. Brother, I'm on my way. I'm wondering where you are tonight. I'm wondering if you are all right. I'm wondering, do you think of me in my misery? Glass. Fill it up to the brim till my troubles grow dim. This my first one today.
Ted Hawkins, welcome to Fresh Air. Your new album is your first album in about 7 years.
Yes.
What's the story of how the producer heard you singing?
I was at a gimme shelter, place where they perform for money to give to the homeless. And the producer was in the audience, and he came back. He was very enthusiastic over my performance, so he came to the dressing room and gave me his card, Tony Bird.
Had he heard you perform before? Did he know who you were?
No, he hadn't heard me before. I was going to tear it up, you know, because every time I look around, somebody was giving me cards, you know, and not doing anything and not following through and putting me on the back burner. I said, here's another one. But I went home and showed it to my son. He said, oh, Daddy, that's Geffen Records. Call those people. So I call them.
So what's the difference between singing in the studio and singing on the boardwalk in terms of the style, the volume that you sing?
It's easier.
Easier in the studio?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it easier?
Because of the fact that on the boardwalk, I have to start singing from 10 in the morning until 6 that evening. And I got to really strain my guts out in order to stop the people. And stopping the people is not enough. You got to hold it, hold them there. And that's a job. That's two jobs. And then they're going to have to like what you're doing.
Did you have a microphone on the boardwalk?
No.
So you have to sing pretty loud, too.
Yes, and eat a lot of sand when there's a windy day.
Well, that must make it harder to sing if you open up your mouth and some sand blows in.
That's down my throat.
Did that hurt your throat?
It caused me to get a nodule.
And did you have to have that removed?
I had to have it removed here in America, but they didn't do it right because all they did was just burn it off, you know, with the laser. It looked good, but it burned off some of the membranes that I needed to sing. So I had to get it done again after I got to London.
You sing a fair amount of country music. How did you start listening to country?
I don't know exactly when, but I know that it began to grow on me because the words were so meaningful. I don't look at a song just because I want to dance and, you know, shake my rump and get all funky. I like to sit down and listen to a real good song, being an adult, you know, that have meaningful words. You see, we don't have those kind of songs no more, especially a good tearjerker,
mm-hmm.
like All I Have to Offer, you know, Chris Chandelier's. That song hit me and turned me every way but loose. And I say, why don't Charlie Pride sing that a little bit more stronger? I mean, since those words are so meaningful, why don't he really, really cry those songs? Why is he just, all I have to, come on. That's a great song, man. Come on and sing, you know. And he wouldn't do it. And so I learned the song, and I did it myself, and it felt a whole lot better, you know, like picking meat out your teeth.
So is that one of the reasons why you'll do a song? Because you thought the first person who recorded it didn't do it justice?
Yes. You ever seen a bump on somebody's forehead that you wish you could burst? They won't go on and bust it. You know what I mean? That's the way it is with people's stuff. They don't seem to do it right. Uh-huh. Yeah, I said, why don't he scream there? He could have easily screamed right there. Why didn't he scream?
No. What about when you sing a song that somebody who you really like recorded, like Sam Cooke or Otis Redding?
There's nothing you can say about Sam's. There's no kind of alternation you can do with Sam's. If you mess around with Sam Cooke's songs, you'll mess it up. Sam Cooke is the greatest singer in the world.
So what do you do when you do one of his songs?
I just lay back and do it, you know, and hope that I'm able to do it, you know, somewhere around the way he does it, you know, because he's a very hard-working, intense young man.
Why don't we hear Having a Party from your Boardwalk Tapes album?
And everybody's swinging. Sally's doing that twist now. If you take requests, I've got a few for you. Play that song called Soul Twist, and play that one called I Know. Don't forget the mashed potatoes, no other songs will do. And let me tell you, Mr. DJ, keep those records playing, 'cause I'm having such a good time dancing with my baby, having a party. Yeah, everybody's swinging, oh, we're dancing to the music. Yeah, on the radio, oh, we're having a party. Man, everybody's swinging, dancing to the music, yeah, on the radio. Tell them one more time, we're having a party.
Ooh, that's Ted Hawkins from his album, The Boardwalk Tapes. That was recorded in 1986. Ted Hawkins, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your background. I know you grew up in Mississippi. Your mother worked as a prostitute. When did you realize what that meant?
I realized what that meant when I was a child. I've seen other prostitutes, you know, walk around among other ones, you know, on the streets. And I knew what was happening, you know, before it was my, before I, you know, while I was a child. Because I was fending for myself, you know.
Were you ever around when she was working?
No, I wasn't. No. I never did hang around home at all that much. I was always out, you know, trying to get something and trying to accumulate something.
How did you take care of yourself as when you were very young?
I'd go down to the beach and I'd get me old crabbing net, and I'd put some meat in the middle of tied in the middle, and let my net all the way down to the bottom, leave about a half hour, come back, and it's full of crabs when I pull it up, and I take them to the house and boil them, you know, and I eat them. I would fish. That's one thing about Biloxi, you know, you can fish and crab, and you can, if you have any ambition at all, you can make it in Biloxi. I'd pick up pecans, and I knew a guy that would give me 25 cents a pound, and 4 pounds, a dollar. And back in those days, a dollar was a dollar.
What were some of the really difficult things you were exposed to as a boy?
Difficult things?
Mm-hmm. Or frightening things?
Frightening things.
Not having the protection of a parent around.
Well, frightening things like... I almost died of malnutrition once. And my bones began to bend. And that was great pain. I remember that vividly. I'm knock-kneed right now. And people that you see bow-legged or knock-kneed, they had trouble eating when they was children. Because when you're a child, those bones are soft. And they, if you don't get the proper nourishment that you need, they will bend. And I'm knock-kneed right now. You know, see, look, I'm so knock-kneed, it looks like I have two left legs.
Now, I know when you were young, you were sent to reform school in Jackson, Mississippi. How did you get in?
When I was 12 years old, I was sent there by my mother. The lady at the city hall talked her into, you know, you can't take care of him anyway. I mean, you know, you might as well send him somewhere he can get some training and some learning and perhaps some schooling. And so she did it. That was in 1949. Oh. I went there, and I learned how to work, get up and go to work, you know, rise and shine. And they gave us grits and grease and and bread and stuff like that. And the staff ate the bacon and stuff. They put the bacon grease over our grits. And we went to the fields, and we hoed and picked potatoes and pulled corn and, you know, the whole bit. That taught me how to fight, you know, how to protect myself. You know, it was other boys. It was a boys' camp, nothing but just boys.
You were coming from a pretty rough life because you had to fend for yourself. As a kid, your mother wasn't really taking care of you. So did reform school seem like an improvement, or did you hate it?
It seemed like a country club.
Compared to what you were used to?
Yes, I got to eat, you know. Eating had been the big EAT right in front of me, you know, eat. That's what had been hunting me all my life. And when I got to Oakley, I was able to eat 3 meals a day, you know, and I was very happy there. Running all over the campus, and just, it was a big campus, and just running wild, just running, just having a good time.
Now, what about music? Were you exposed to more music there? Did you sing while you were there?
I met a guy by the name of Professor Longhair.
Oh, the great New Orleans pianist.
Yes, he would come there, and he would walk among the boys, and he would talk to the boys and stuff like that, and he'd ask me to beat the hem bone for me there. And then I'd beat the hem bone for him, pop my mouth, and he liked me. And one day he saw a bunch of children hanging around me, and I was singing for them. I can't exactly remember the song I was singing, but I'd always sing, you know, something for the kids. And he went and told Miss William. Miss William was Professor G.W. Williams' wife. That's two people who was head of that place, Oakland Training School, where I was.
Mm-hmm.
She played the piano also. She took me to the chapel, and him and her taught me a song called Somebody's Knocking at Your Door. And he played the piano, and she accompanied me. They took me to Jackson, Mississippi, put me on a stage. I was behind the curtain, and the people, somebody called my name, you know, Ted Hawkins, and my little heart jumped in my neck, and I start trembling and shaking. My knees got weak. My legs started itching, and I didn't know which way to go. I was scared to death. I froze and didn't move. The lady behind me, Miss Williams, she gave me a push. She shoved me on out there, and I started singing and tore the house down. Everybody in the place rushed up there. You know, can you imagine a lot of people rushing up to you, you know, from the audience?
Mm-hmm.
They picked me up and turned me around and kissed me and hugged me and squeezed me and said, oh, you got such a wonderful voice. You know, that felt good to me. I liked it, and I wanted some more of that, but I didn't know how to go about getting it again.
My guest is singer and guitarist Ted Hawkins. In 1986, he recorded a series of solos that was released as the Boardwalk Tapes. From that CD, this is Your Cheatin' Heart.
Your cheatin' heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep. But sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you. When tears come down like falling rain, you're tossed around.
We'll be back with more of the interview with Ted Hawkins after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with singer Ted Hawkins. So what did you do when you got out of reform school?
I didn't do nothing. I just, played it by ear and wind up stealing a motorcycle jacket. And I went to the Parchment Penitentiary without a trial. They didn't even give me a trial.
So when you got out of the penitentiary, I think you hopped a train and went north. To places like Chicago and then Buffalo, New York, which is pretty far north. Yeah, go ahead.
The first place I went the wrong way. I was trying to get to the north, and I went to Florida. I went down that map. And they say, no, Ted, it's back that way. So then I started climbing up the side of that map, and I got to Chicago and New York and Philadelphia.
Well, how did you end up going to L.A.?
I was in Geneva, New York, and I came across some money, and I asked the lady, where on earth could I go where it don't get cold? And she said, Los Angeles, California. I said, give me a one-way ticket.
I don't know if this is something you want to talk about or not, but I had read that you were married for a while, and your wife died of cancer
mm-hmm.
and left you $5,000.
Yes.
And then you started giving away a lot of the money.
That's how I come into the money. I didn't give away a lot of it, but what I did was I didn't do it right because I wasn't used to having money.
Mm-hmm.
I everywhere I'd go, I would go in a cab, you know, and I'd spend and spend foolishly. You know, I still have that problem, you know, sometime to spend foolishly because I'm not used to money. The Bible say, a fool and his money will soon part.
So after living in the North for a while, you bought a train ticket to Los Angeles. You wanted to get to a place that was warm.
First class.
First class ticket?
To Santa Fe.
Oh, wow, that must have been neat.
It was beautiful. It had a skyway that you can see, you know, everything. I had my own room.
That must have been great, because I know you hopped freight cars to get north, so.
Mm-hmm, I did.
Yeah, so that's much more in style.
It was a great change.
So how did you start singing on the boardwalk?
I was singing downtown Los Angeles. There was other people, you know, down there, standing, Jehovah Witnesses and things, you know, so I thought maybe it was okay for me to sing. There was other people. Every now and then you see a guy sitting on the corner playing. But while they was doing that, the people was passing right on by. But when I started singing, the people stopped, and the crowd started backing up in the street. So the police say, what's happening down there? And they made it down there and say, hey, what? Move on. What are you doing? I said, I'm sorry. I saw everybody else singing, so I just thought I would, you know, do it too, you know. You can't, you know, you cause chaos. You move on. Pick up your stuff and go. I said, well, where can I go? And somebody said, well, Ted, why don't you go to Venice Beach? I said, where's that at? They said, get the Venice bus and ride to the end of the line, and there you are on Venice Beach. I said, all right. I did that. And I seen all those people walking both ways, fire eaters, people standing on their head, people walking on glass. I said, what is this? And I said, oh, look at the folks. Look at the money. I said, oh, my goodness alive. I said, this is heaven on earth. And I stood there and sang. And I had a cigar box, you know, and my feet started getting tired. I said, oh, my God, I want to sit down. I ain't got nothing to sit on. And I started walking the back streets until I found a milk crate. It was in 1974. I started walking the back streets. And I took the milk crate back to the boardwalk, and I sit there, and I've been doing that ever since.
So what would you make on an average day? In the 70s?
Not that much. Not enough to write home about, but just enough to keep me going, to keep my head above water.
So here you are singing on the beach. You still don't think of yourself as a singer. When did you start thinking of yourself as a performer?
When I went to London and start singing for 1 hour, you know, I became affiliated with an agency called Asgard Agency, and they was sending me different places. You know, I was start singing at the Hammersmith Odeon. I brought on a guy by the name of John Lee Hooker, and I sung at the Town Country, and many places.
The Hammersmith Odeon is a big theater.
Mm-hmm.
So how did your life change in England?
It didn't change that much, you know, not half as the way it's changing now. But it changed, you know, somewhat. I brought an album back, you know, so that's positive.
What's it been like for you now that the record's coming out and you're doing some promotion for it? Is this a new experience for you?
It is a new experience. It's a great experience. I'm working, I'm tired, and I'm loving it. Because I know every move that I make, I'm making it for Ted Hawkins.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Singer Ted Hawkins. Rounder Records is reissuing their two Ted Hawkins albums, and Geffen just released Hawkins' new album, The Next 100 Years. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I had a strange conversation. My baby called me on the phone. She said that your next lover's gonna be the blues, 'cause that I'm gonna be gone. Day's gonna be.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Gloria Steinem turned 40, she said, "This is what 40 looks like. We've been lying so long, who would know?" In her new book, Steinem reflects on turning 60. Coming up, we talk with Steinem about her new book, which also features essays on the politics of muscle and sex, lies, and advertising. And we remember writer John Preston. He died of AIDS last week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Echoing American Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela says black South Africans are free at last. Mandela was claiming victory in the country's first all-race elections. His party, the African National Congress, has a commanding lead of about 35 points, with counting of the paper ballots continuing. Mandela addressed supporters in Johannesburg, and NPR's Michael Scholar was there.
He basically called for all the different parties in the election to work together in the new government of national unity, where he reminded his followers that they needed to extend an open hand to their opponents, even in areas where the African National Congress did not win a majority of seats, though it looks like they've swept 7 of the 9 provinces here, so they've won a majority almost everywhere.
Mandela says the current president, F.W. de Klerk, has called and promised his cooperation. Earlier, de Klerk had said, for the first time, the government of South Africa represents all the people. President Clinton has urged disabled Americans to push Congress to pass his health care reform plan. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton spoke to a cheering crowd of disabled Americans and their advocates today at the White House. He told them that his health care plan would give tax credits for some handicapped workers and would offer benefits the disabled community wants. He encouraged them to call members of Congress who voted for the Americans with Disabilities Act, but who have not yet made up their minds about health care reform. The president wants the disabled Americans to convince these lawmakers that his critics are wrong when they say the White House health care plan is too bureaucratic.
When we try to fix it, what do our adversaries say? They're trying to have the government take over the healthcare system. False. Private insurance, private providers, empowerment for this man, this woman, these children, their family, and their future.
A handful of congressional committees are working towards a May 30th deadline to come up with modified versions of the president's healthcare reform plan. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Supreme Court has turned down John Gotti's appeal for his murder and racketeering convictions. He had argued that the prosecutor prejudiced the jury by saying they would be less than human if they didn't feel some personal concern. Gotti's appeal says that implied Gotti was so evil that the government might not be able to protect the jurors from him. The Supreme Court rejected the appeal without comment. Gotti is serving a life prison sentence for 5 murders and other mob activities. The justices also turned down appeals today by Raymond Jr. Patriarca and 4 other men convicted on organized crime charges in New England. Patriarca unsuccessfully argued that his 8-year sentence was based on acts committed by lower-level mobsters. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrials gaining more than 19 points. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR News. The Commerce Department says spending for all kinds of building construction rose in March after falling during the severe winter. The improvement in March was only 0.8 percentage point, less than analysts had predicted. The increase was held down by a drop in spending for government buildings. Spending on single residences, apartment buildings, and office buildings rose. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has met with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and given him details of the latest peace proposal from Syria. Christopher didn't make public what the Syrians had come up with in response to an Israeli peace proposal. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Secretary Christopher said there's still a long way to go in negotiations between Israel and Syria, but said the two countries were now discussing a broad range of issues. Earlier, he said the talks had entered a new, more substantive phase, but provided no details. Israeli officials also had no comment on the Syrian proposals. saying they need time to analyze what the Syrians had to say. Israel has offered Syria a phased withdrawal from the Golan Heights in exchange for full peace. Publicly, Syrian officials have dismissed that idea as unacceptable. Christopher indicated he does not have a date for resumption of direct talks between Syria and Israel, and said he would not be involved in more shuttle diplomacy during this trip to the Middle East, which may indicate he's been unable to break the stalemate between the two countries. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
The talks between Israel and the PLO are continuing in Cairo as they work toward a final agreement on Palestinian rule in the Gaza Strip and Jericho. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin warned today that if the Palestinian police force that will be established does not prevent guerrilla attacks on Israelis, the deal is off. Terror attacks on Israelis have increased as the two sides have moved closer to finer self-rule terms. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Gloria Steinem says that life after 50 or 60 is a whole new country. It's a territory she's been exploring. In her previous book, the bestseller Revolution from Within, she wrote about how after devoting all her time to feminist activism, she'd started looking inward and realizing the importance of self-esteem to revolution. In her new book, Moving Beyond Words, she writes about her thoughts on turning 60. She also writes about the politics of muscle, and sex, lies, and advertising. Steinem is a founder of Ms. Magazine. In 1989, Ms. gave up advertising. Steinem says Ms. never attracted enough ads to break even. She was told that the magazine didn't have a, quote, supportive editorial atmosphere for the typical advertiser. She told me advertisers in women's magazines expect the articles to praise advertisers' products.
If you don't have recipes and articles about entertaining, you don't get ads for food. If you don't have fashion spreads, you don't get ads for clothes. If you don't have little diagrams of where to put your rouge, you don't get beauty products. And I always used to say to them, look, you know, you put ads for shaving cream in men's magazines without there having articles every month on how to shave. our readers will look at these ads, but they don't need or want articles about how to use the products. But it was really blowing in the wind for the most part. I mean, it was much easier to get cars and financial services and audio equipment, all kinds of things that had never advertised to women before, than it was to get the traditional women's products without their control of the copy surrounding them. And I hope so much that women will read this and take action, because our women's magazines are imprisoned by this stuff. It's not that the rest of the media isn't, but in degree, it's much more in women's magazines.
You say that sometimes advertisers would have contracts that specified things about editorial content, for instance, how close or how far away an ad had to be from a certain type of article. Would you explain how those contracts work?
They give you what are called insertion orders, and it just flat out says, you know, this our ad is to be in no issue or surrounded by no articles that are negative, downbeat, about large size fashion, older women, you know, whatever it is that they consider is not compatible with their product. Incidentally, there is no research anywhere that shows that an article, say, about makeup or fragrance works better if it is next to an article, an ad about makeup or fragrance works better if it's next to an article about the same subject matter than it would next to fiction or investigative reporting. There is no such research, but they own women's magazines and they will not give up this control.
Were you ever in a tough position where you actually considered changing or killing an article so as not to offend an advertiser?
Well, I like to believe that we stood up as much as we possibly could, and I think we did. We certainly got knocked down enough, so and we never did break even, so I think we were pretty true to our principles. But we did do things, for instance, if there were words, sexual or other words, in a story or an article that we knew the advertisers would object to, we wouldn't put it in a blurb. We would just leave it in the small text and hope that they didn't read it, you know. Or we would have to tell, if we were doing a health issue, and with a lot of critical stuff in it that might be considered negative atmosphere, we would tell the advertiser in advance so that they wouldn't come into that issue, but they'd come into a later issue. And there occasionally there were things that I now, at the time, you know, I thought we were doing our best, but I regret. And I record one in this piece because Andrea Dworkin had used Volkswagen in a piece on Nazi pornography. And they were one of our best advertisers, and all they asked was not to be called Nazis anymore, you know. So I changed it to car, I think, instead of Porsche or whatever the Volkswagen was. And Andrea was angry at me, and she was right to be angry at me. So I put this in as an apology. You sometimes got worn down, but by and large, I'm proud of the fact that we never, never gave in to the, you know, food, fashion, good cheer, marzipan idea of what we were supposed to be. When the Canadian, there were two very good and smart Canadian feminists who eventually bought the magazine when we could no longer keep going financially. And they did try a little bit to change it to suit the advertisers, to have articles about products, to have gardening and, you know, other things. And it didn't work. You know, it wasn't enough to please the advertisers, but it was enough to displease the readers.
Hmm. How has the experiment of publishing Ms. Magazine without advertisements worked out so far?
Wonderfully. It does my heart so much good, I can't begin to tell you, because all those years that we were struggling to keep going financially, the general media attitude towards us was, well, women don't want a feminist magazine, that's why you're having such a, you know, you're not doing well. And now we've finally been able to show what we were saying to them all the time, which is it is not the readers, it is the advertisers who are the problem. We are making money. We were able to give some of the profits to the Ms. Foundation for Women last year. And this is totally on income from readers, nothing else, not one single ad.
Gloria Steinem is my guest. She has a new book called Moving Beyond Words. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Gloria Steinem. You have an article in your new collection, Moving Beyond Words, about turning 60. And I want to start this chapter by asking you to explain the origins of your now famous statement, "This is what 40 looks like."
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to, because I think in later years it's been kind of truncated. Well, when I turned 40, I turned publicly 40 because there had been a period of a few years in which I had not told the truth about my age. That is, I had to make myself younger to do an expose of working as a Playboy bunny, and for a series of reasons having to do with my sister and her children thought she was younger and so on, I ended up making myself 2 years younger, and I felt awful. I mean, it's really interesting how falsifying just one thing about yourself can really make you feel foolish and bad, and it all had to do with giving in to convention, because in my teenage years I had lied about my age by much more. You know, I'd made myself 6, 7, 8 years older to get work. That was defeating the system, but this was giving in to the system. So when I became 40, I became publicly 40, and some reporter kindly said to me, "You don't look 40," and I said, unplanned, I mean, just spontaneously, you know, "This is what 40 looks like. We've been lying so long, who would know?" And I got the most incredible response to this comment. It made me realize that how deep age discrimination is for women, because I got such gratitude for this comment. But then in later years, people began to leave off, "We've been lying so long, who would know?" And there was this notion that I was saying that people should look like me, which was the very contrary. I meant that we should all look like whatever we look like.
Now, in this essay about turning 60, you write, I used to think that continuing my past sex life was the height of radicalism. After all, women too old for childbearing were supposed to be tools for sex. Now I think, why not take advantage of hormonal changes? Now, what changed your thinking about this, and what would it mean now to take advantage of hormonal changes?
Well, hormones changed my thinking. I think post-menopause, supposing that one is not on hormone replacement therapy, there is, in my experience, perhaps this is not everyone's experience, a change in the way you think. In other words, that little part of your brain that was always reliably devoted to sex and you could turn around in your head and it was always there, and if you, you know, if you hadn't had sex in a long time, it might start to take over the rest of your brain. It's gone. And it just releases all these brain cells for other things. It doesn't mean you don't enjoy sex when you have it. It just means that you don't, it doesn't matter. It's just another part of life. It's and those brain cells are free for other things. It's just wonderful. It is, you know, think again about that 8 or 9 or 10 year old state of mind that was so clear for many of us, you know, before the hormones arrived and before the female role arrived. You come back to that again. And I cherish it. You know, it's and I, as I say in the book, I begin to wonder, looking back at my life, whether I sometimes confuse sex with aerobics.
Yeah, what do you mean by that? I'd written that down because I wanted you to interpret that for me.
With exercise, I don't really mean that exactly, because I certainly was self-protective enough so that I never got involved with men I didn't trust. But still, I think I turned to sex for all kinds of other things, intimacy, sensuousness, exercise
right? Right.
And I wonder if, in retrospect, if I wasn't a little out of proportion, you know, in those years.
I should mention here that one of my producers has just expressed disbelief that that's something you said, which is that you never got involved with a man you didn't trust.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a completely true statement? Should anybody find that hard to believe?
I guess there's one exception, to be completely honest about this.
Okay.
But I tell you what I think what made that both possible and necessary for me. The possible part is that I had a father who was a nurturing father. He took care of me because my mother was incapacitated. So I grew up knowing something very important, which most women don't get a chance to experience, which is that there are loving, nurturing, trustworthy men. It is possible. Since most women statistically have probably had distant, absent, or even violent fathers, I think the impetus to look for trust is not necessarily there. You know, you don't really know that it's possible. You don't see it growing up, so you don't know it. The second thing is that I grew up in a very tough neighborhood, at least in my teenage years. And it was very important. There were only two kinds of girls, nice and not nice. And the punishment for being a not nice girl was unspeakable. You know, you could get locked up in somebody's garage and gangbanged, as they refer to it, by the entire football team for a whole weekend, and the family would have to move out of town. I mean, you know, it was incredible. So I out of self-protectiveness, I also looked for men I trusted. And I'm grateful that I had these two influences in my life. At the same time, I recognize that just statistically, it's hard to avoid violent men, you know, no matter how good one's judgment is. So I realize I've been lucky, too.
Mm-hmm. What came over you that you violated your instincts for one relationship?
Fatigue. I got so tired that I started to look for somebody who I wouldn't have to. I felt like I was taking care of the earth, you know, so I was looking for somebody I wouldn't have to take care of. And that was really too bad, because I ended up by hurting his feelings as well as being untrue to myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Gloria Steinem's new book is called Moving Beyond Words. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, this is Noah Adams with a word about All Things Considered coming up. In South Africa, a declared winner, Nelson Mandela, a concession from President F.W. de Klerk. Michael Scholar reports on the outcome of the South African election. I'll talk with an official of the Rwanda Patriotic Front. He says his forces have not been taking revenge on the Hutu people in Rwanda, and that the Patriotic Front will attend a peace meeting in Tanzania tomorrow, but will not speak directly with members of the interim government of Rwanda. Also, spotted owls in California. More and more are being seen in the northern part of the state, but environmentalists there still maintain the spotted owls are indeed threatened. That's coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Writer, editor, and AIDS activist John Preston died last week at the age of 48. We're going to remember him with an excerpt of a 1992 interview. Preston wrote or edited more than 40 books. He had great range. He was known for his gay pornography, as well as his books about the hometowns and families of gay men. His papers were being collected by Brown University's John Hay Library. In the opening essay to his anthology, A Member of the Family, Gay Men Write About Their Families, Preston wrote, "I had to leave my family to be gay."
I had to leave my family because I wasn't willing to subject my much younger brothers to the potential ridicule and damage they could do if I were to be the public person I wanted to be.
Your brothers were 15 and 17 years younger than you.
Yeah.
What were you afraid would happen to them if you were out in your hometown while they were growing up?
Oh, you really have to remember that we're talking about the early 60s, when there was no context for a gay life and no context for gay activism. And the idea of being publicly identified as a homosexual at that point in time, and especially for them living in a small New England town, was impossible. It would have been quite devastating.
So you left to protect them, but you later found out that one of them thought that didn't really understand that that's why you left.
No, he didn't. And it was one of the great shocks in my life when he came to me when he was 18 years old and gave me his side of the story.
Which was what?
I had left a letter to my parents explaining that I needed to go, that I wasn't being able to do what I had to do with my life in our hometown, and accusing all of us of being quite crazy and incapable. What I didn't know was that my brother had found that letter and that he had felt that he was the one who was at fault, and that it was his fault that I had left home and abandoned him.
What couldn't you have done with living in the same town as your family?
Well, I guess the best way to answer that is to tell you what I did do. I moved to Minneapolis. Precisely because I knew no one. I had no history there. I was unfettered. And I went about recreating my own life. I became a very well-known activist in the Twin Cities. I established the first gay community center in the United States in Minneapolis. I started the first counseling center for lesbians and gay men that was federally funded, and became this part of the new people who were coming about right after the Stonewall Revolution about 25 years ago. But I also did it with a great deal of, I can't say flamboyance. That probably has too many other connotations. But I did it without restriction. I was on television. I was in the daily newspaper. I picketed. I did all those wonderful things that young activists do with their surge of self-righteousness.
Now, you've written a lot of pornography, and to a lot of people, that's just the lowest form of literature that there is. You obviously don't agree with that. What do you think the importance of pornography is?
Well, I think, I think there are so many different ways in which it's important. You know, although I have to admit that I started writing pornography precisely because I didn't think it was important. I had to be taught by readers that it was. I decided, well, I'll write some pornography and no one will pay attention to it. And so I began, the first piece of fiction I ever wrote was became the first chapter in a novel called Mr. Benson. And I was convinced that, you know, this was like a free down in a game or something. No one would ever notice I had done it. But it immediately became this cult classic. And I was living in New York at the time, and I discovered going to work that people were wearing T-shirts looking for Mr. Benson. And so I thought, well, my God, I have to take this very seriously, don't I?
You have a really interesting essay that was reprinted in an anthology called High Risk. Mm-hmm. And this was the beginning of the essay was about how you had written your first pornographic short story, and you'd foolishly left it on the kitchen table, where it was soon discovered by your grandmother, who read it. And after she read it, she said to you,
"How dare you think these things?"
Yeah. And what was your response to that? How dare you think these things?
I was horrified. I mean, I felt totally shamed. I felt I had done something just horrible in even thinking these things. She tore up that story, by the way, in front of me. And I didn't write fiction again until Mr. Benson.
How many years was that?
Oh, boy. 20.
And you think that has to do with the fact that your grandmother was so upset and had torn it up?
Oh, it certainly told me how dangerous it was going to be to have thoughts like that on paper.
John Preston, he died last Wednesday at the age of 48. Soon to be published are the three books he completed shortly before he died, Flesh and the Word, Volume 3, Friends and Lovers, Gay Men Write About the Families They Create, and Sisters and Brothers, About Lesbians and Gay Men. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the unspeakable, what happens to the body after death. It's the subject of Dr. Kenneth Iserson's new book, Death to Dust. He says he wrote it for anyone who is afraid to donate his organs after death out of fear it will mutilate his body. Death is a mutilating experience, Iserson says. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.